We're so privileged to have these gentlemen. Tom Wright is not only an outstandingly gifted historian and New Testament scholar who's written extensively on the New Testament and its historic basis. He's working through progressively a commentary on the whole of the New Testament, written at a popular level, and books that have sold in their hundreds of thousands. And he's that's what I was told by SBCK. And Professor Anthony Flew is a well-known British philosopher, internationally known, and for many decades of his life was renowned as an atheist. And it's in just recent times, a number of arguments have been brought to bear on him, and he has completely changed his position on that, has gone public on it, and most of his opponents have accused him of being senile, and that the book was entirely ghostwritten by somebody else. Something that Professor Flew has strongly protested, and you'll be able to judge for yourself today whether he's senile or not. So I hand over now to Dr. Gary Habermas.
Thank you. Should we carry on from back here, or our discussion? Okay, I'll tell you what, I'll say a brief introduction, and then I'm going to go back and sit down with the gentleman. Peter, this goes for a half hour? Right. Okay. Well, some of you may have gotten a note about, besides the two of us, Tom and myself speaking, that we have a special guest today. And if you've never seen this gentleman here in the middle, good buddy, for 25 years, a delightful individual. We're tickled to have him here today. And I pulled some questions for him, and he's going to We'll see how long the questions go, if we get past number one or if we get to five, or we'll see. But that book we're talking about, which I understand has not been released in Britain, I'm not sure
As far as I know, it hasn't been. I mean, you have to ask for someone to import a copy. And the fact is, the secularization of the United Kingdom is such that it's not an obvious profit-making book.
would you hand me a copy of the book? And let me. This is a pre-pub copy. It's a great cover. You have to kind of look to see this. But Tony's picture is upside down on the book, faintly. I think it meant this guy did an about face or something. And the title, as you can see, There Is No God. And no is scribbled out, looks like in hand, with the word A written above it. And as he says early in the book, he did not write the subtitle. It's called How the World's Most Notorious Atheist Changed His Mind. The co-author is Roy Abraham Varghese, a real gentleman, a friend of both Tony's and mine. And you've already heard some of the questions. So we thought we would give Professor Flew an opportunity to respond. Now, one of the reasons Professor Wright is up here is because he has a marvelous response in the back in an appendix where he does some outlining of some key features of historical Jesus and resurrection, to which Professor Flew has a brief response at the end. So in a sense, you're seeing two of the gentlemen here. You add Roy Varghese from the States, and you basically have this. Now, we were talking about this ahead of time, and Tony said, I would like to make some comments about Richard Dawkins. You may know that there's been a little bit of a match going back and forth, and in Dawkins's book, he makes a comment, something like, in a footnote, something like, Tony Flew used to be an excellent philosopher until he got soft-headed and started believing in God. And then actually, Dawkins came to our town, and I heard him say publicly, he said, I think he's a little bit senile, and that's why he's become a deist. And then this comment, well, I shouldn't be surprised. You know, when you get elderly like this, you want to hedge your bets against heaven. Well, you have to know Tony, and you have to talk to him. He'll tell you, he'll say, I dearly hope there's no heaven. I don't want to talk about an afterlife. There's no hedging bets here. And over again, there's a chapter by this title, over and over again, he says, I simply had to go where the evidence took me. He said it's Aristotle's principle. Some of the principles of intelligent design were helpful, he said, but the biggest argument, Aristotle's cosmology. All right, with that little introduction, both parts by these gentlemen, I told Tony earlier, if he wants to respond first, here's the question as I wrote it up. Dr. Flew, in your recent book, There Is a God, there are some strong statements regarding the work of Oxford University biologist Richard Dawkins. Would you please comment on what you think are the relevant issues here? And go ahead and take a shot at the senility thing if you want to.
The basic question is whether that particular critic of mine is actually concerned about the truth at all. Because had he wanted to know about my change of opinions, he could easily have looked up in Who's Who and possibly written me a letter. I mean, I'm not on the other thing. I don't even remember the name of it. But after the way I would find to raise a question to a scholar, is I would write to him, as I have done to hundreds of people over the years. No, I think he doesn't want to believe, because he simply doesn't do anything to find out what I really do. He just produces a contemptuous thing that is a matter of senile decay. Well, I think it's fairly obvious that I am a bit arthritic, but I'm not yet absolutely past it. It's failure to inquire. I have followed my whole academic life on the principle that Plato scripted his Socrates to proclaim, we must follow the argument wherever it leads. And the result of following this principle eventually led me to something I didn't at all expect to be. But as it was the truth, I had to accept it. That I was interested in truth. I don't think Dawkins is, because he wanted to know the truth about me. He could have found it out by asking me. After all, there was a sort of media sensation about this on both English-speaking sides of the Atlantic. I think it was 5 years ago. And this resulted in my publishing in a quarterly, a very small quarterly journal, issued by the Royal Institute of Philosophy to say that I had changed my mind for that reason. And I don't know whether the media was before or after that, but that's the whole story, a perfectly simple story, that any scholar who'd done, behaved in the way I behaved throughout my life of putting a question directly to a fellow scholar rather than challenging his writings and so on. And of course, if he said this was the reason why I disagreed, he disagreed, I had to do something about it and answer his question. Well, that's it. That's the only interesting thing that I can offer.
Since you're on this topic, any comments about discussion we've had many, many times, Dawkins as a biologist in Oxford University?
Well, I'm not qualified in any way in biology, but I have been told by, actually, it was in, I think, Biola University, that I was shown some statistical results of giving random letters, you know, letter A, letter B, and so on, giving a purely random run of random, and seeing how often even the shortest words in the English language would turn up. And it's a simply fabulously improper one. And to think that the collected works of Shakespeare might have really, it's just crazy. Well, you know, this is not the last word, but it is something that the biologists ought to be thinking about. And if you're a professional biologist, and apparently are not even aware that this research has been done, it suggests to me that if I had been his vice chancellor, I would have suggested that he find a doctor to declare he was in need of early retirement. What else could the vice chancellor do? I've never been a vice chancellor, but I've known enough vice chancellors to know what good ones would have done. They'd have tried to get rid of this disgrace to the university.
Should I comment on that?
Professor Wright, I just wonder if I, by the way, I'm no longer a professor, but thanks for the title. But it's, I think we should just contextualize these questions within where we are in British culture right now. It's been extraordinary over the last months, never mind the last 3 or 4 years, how the question of God refuses to go away. I was on the station platform in Darlington at 6:45 this morning and saw that the current issue of The Spectator has a full-page article by somebody who I confess I hadn't heard of on why I don't believe in God. Now, a few years ago, it would have been extraordinary to think that The Spectator would see any need or interest to publish a piece on why I don't believe in God. It would just be assumed, what's God got to do with anything?
You know? Yeah.
But now, the question of God is back on the agenda, and people are scared. There is a standoff between secularism and fundamentalism. And if you take a God position, you're assumed to be one of those dangerous religious nuts. And then we're in danger sometimes, actually, of playing the same game back and assuming that anyone who's even slightly skeptic is a hard-line secularist. In fact, there are lots of shades of grey in between. But I'm surprised the book hasn't been published in England yet, and I think it should be, though you can always get it on Amazon.com, for goodness sake. It's not hard.
I'm all for that.
Yeah, well, quite. Absolutely. But because I think people are asking these questions in fresh ways. And it's a shame that the flagship for secularism at the moment should include people like Richard Dawkins, because as far as I know, he's a very, very able communicator of certain types of biology. You know, his books on his previous books, explaining scientific concepts for the masses, I think are quite brilliant. He's an extraordinary communicator. But that particular book, The God Delusion, he just hasn't bothered. It's just a sort of a hand-waving sort of exercise which doesn't advance serious thought and argument at all.
Tony, on page 213 in the book, you remark regarding Dr. Wright's thoughts on the historicity of Jesus, and you call them, quote, absolutely fresh, absolutely wonderful, absolutely radical, and very powerful, end quote. Would you comment on the uniqueness of Christian revelation claims, especially regarding the resurrection of Jesus, as compared to other miracle claims?
Well, as far as I know, it's the, I think the American phrase is the only game in town. The only other religion I know anything about is Buddhism, because my father-in-law was the British imperial official dealing with that area. And this meant that he eventually had to order the dropping of all the railway engines into the river before the Japanese, and then walk through the jungle to the nearest place where there was a white person doing some sort of farm work. And of course, by the traditions of the air, immediately he came in, and they said, well, the dinner will be so, and the bathroom's after. You know, they reckoned, you know, that it was their business to deal with refugees.
Now, you said, though, that as far as comparative religion claims, you said there's some comment in there, something like,
if you want to deal with special revelation, Christianity is the place to start.
Yeah, it seems so, because the only other one which I mustn't mention here is different, but that is the other one with which I would naturally compare it, but I'm not going to here.
Okay, how about special revelation, the possibility of special revelation in your own life? On pages 158 and 213, you mentioned more than once, you say, "I've never heard from God, but I'm personally open to the idea of divine revelation because," you say, "not much is impossible for an omnipotent being." So could you add a couple of remarks regarding the notion of, although you yourself don't hold to Christianity and don't hold to special revelation, I'm speaking about the comments in the book where you say, "I remain open, and if God wants to ring you up, so to speak, if he wants to chat with you, you're willing to have a little discussion."
Well, that would be in accordance with my fundamental principle of inquiry. You know, it's not that I think this is at all likely. That it's a question about me, and I give the answer about me.
So,
which is that, you know, as long as I'm capable of understanding the questions, I'm prepared to try to answer any question that is put to me. And if the question is an experience, I'll think about that.
So you'd say you were open to
further... Yes, but this doesn't mean... Yes, of course I am, but it doesn't mean that I think it's in any way likely to happen. You know, and my knowledge of other religions is very limited. I only know about Burmese and about the appalling things that are going on in Burma, because the army is making its living out of the population and just murdering the people who protest.
Could I press you, Dr. Flew, on, obviously having read the book, indeed taken part in the book, on what we are meaning by the word God? Because when you say there is a God, I think, again, one of the things that's happened in our culture in very recent times is that many people in Britain now realize that the word God is not univocal, that it can have several different reference, and that there are different types of divinity. And so I'm just interested to hear you talk about what you mean by the word God. Is this God, for instance, the creator of the world? Is this God, for instance, planning to do anything in the future to or with or in the world? And how would you know?
Well, I don't know how I would know in this, but I have met other ideas of God, but this is the only one that is, with the unmentionable exception, the case in Europe.
Well, now, of course, we've got so many different religious traditions here in England, too, and famously, if you walk from those great British landmarks, Regent's Park Zoo, to Lord's Cricket Ground, you go right past the London Mosque. Now, that wouldn't have been so in my childhood, let alone yours, but it's a reality where we are now. I mean, when you look at the different options of meaning for the word God, could you tell us who this God is that you now affirm the existence of?
It's the God of Christianity.
Well, the God of Christianity with Jesus in there as well? Or is this a creator who might have a son but we don't know? Or where are we on that? Gary referred before to your views in terms of deism, a God who is perhaps the maker of the world, but
Yes. That is what I believe, as so many of the founding fathers of the American Republic believe.
Ah, yes.
Which sharply differentiated them from the murderous secularists in France. A very important political difference at that time.
Yes. It is. That's why
it helped the British Empire to continue in existence, which it might not have but if, done, but for the abominable behaviour of the French. That's not a reference to the French people in this room, if any. I'm not wanting to be rude about Frenchmen. I'm just referring to the fact of history. This happened. If you want to be rude about the British, as many people do.
We could do that too. Could I press you, though, on the... You say it's the Christian God, but at the same time you're saying this is a deist God. Where are we then in between those two? Because most Christian theologians would say that deism is quite a large step away from a historic Christian view of God.
Of course it is, but it's just the believer of an omnipotent first cause of the universe. I think that would be the definition, wouldn't it?
That would be one definition of a deist God, yes. An omnipotent first cause. And clearly, from your argument before, with the parallel about monkeys typing Shakespeare and so on, that if you look at the natural order, what you're saying is... this natural order is only explicable
by that sort of cause.
Yes, and clearly that is an argument which has had a long history, and finally it has, as it were, crept up on you and made you think, yes, that's right.
Yeah.
Yes.
Absolutely.
But how would you then know if this omnipotent first cause were actually fully revealed or more fully revealed in or as Jesus of Nazareth? How might one assess that?
It would be, I suppose, by fundamentally the sort of evidence that you're considering producing.
Well, that Gary and I are trying to work on with regard to the resurrection and so on.
I think so. Mm. And it would be an otherwise impossible event like the resurrection. I think that's why the resurrection is relevant here.
Yes, yes.
It's got to be unique. Mm. It's got to be unique for it to do the purpose that you want it to do.
Right, right. I've got lots of other questions, but Gary, go on.
Well, just one. You mentioned Biola University. While you were there, you did an interview that is on YouTube and other places, in case you didn't know that. But the interviewer was asking you how many classical attributes of God would you espouse. And it's been a while since I've seen the interview, but he went down the list and he said, is God omnipotent? And you said, yes, I would think so, to create the world. And he said, how about omniscient? And he said, how about omnipresent? And you were thinking through each one vis-a-vis your deism, and you know, you were saying things like, well, there's more than one way we can go here, but yes, I roughly assume the traditional attributes. I don't know if that helps or...
Well, I always like visiting the United States, and I always like meeting American students, and yes,
but that
I enjoyed the whole thing, and I did the best I could with answering the questions then. But that's a different thing from, well, I've now just been trying to answer them.
He's doing a good job.
Yes.
What Professor Flew is referring to is that he went to Biola University in California a couple of years ago, and he was the second recipient of a prize, the first version of which had been given to Philip Johnson, and he was the second, and I forgot exactly what it was for, but it was for somebody who had contributed mightily to human knowledge by basically going where the evidence leads, and that was the text for this, and they gave him this award, and he got to take his wife, Annis, and went over there, and it was a great occasion. But Tom, if you have another one, go ahead.
I was, in terms of your previous philosophical work, and I should say when I was a student, I had Professor Flew's books on my reading list and some of them on my shelf, and it's extraordinary for me years later to find myself sitting next to the man himself in such an occasion. But I'm just interested in terms of your philosophical conversation partners, the people who over the years you've debated with, as to where you would see people who you might say the glass is half full as opposed to half empty. From what you said about Plato, I wonder if you would say that Plato, or perhaps Socrates, was in some sense a Christian before Christ. I know some of the second century apologists would have said that. Justin Martyr toyed with the idea that God was making himself known through Greek philosophy and so on. I mean, would you be prepared to say that, or would you rather say that actually to be a Christian you need the full revelation of God in Jesus?
Yes, and that's the thing that makes Christians distinctive.
But even though, sorry, your microphone may not be picking you up.
It's that was a great comment.
Yes.
You could pick it up.
So you'd say that what makes Christians distinctive is not so much the belief in the possibility of a good God, that, you know, Socrates seems to have had something like that. It goes beyond that.
It is only the story of the resurrection, basically. Yes. The obvious miracle, if it actually happened, you see, the obvious miracle, and the nature of it, Christ,
is
the crucial figure.
And what about the third person of the Trinity? Because when Christians talk about God classically, it comes out threefold, and you see that happening already in the New Testament, that, you know, when Paul wants to talk about the oneness of God, he actually keeps on saying things like Father, Lord, and Spirit, or whatever, that you get these phrases which just pop out. In your own thinking about God, where might the Holy Spirit fit in? I mean, I take it that a deist, which I think is sort of what you've said you are, might want to be a little coy about the Holy Spirit as a personal presence of this same God working because of Jesus in hearts and lives and communities and so on.
Certainly, I agree. That's a totally different thing.
Would you be open to that as a possibility? And again, if your question about Jesus comes back to the resurrection, what would the question about the Holy Spirit come back
well,
to?
Well, I think the resurrection, if I believed in it, would make me begin to wonder about the rest of the Christian religion.
Would open your mind to the possibility.
But the resurrection is, in my mind, absolutely crucial. It's this case which seems to me the only case available anywhere for the occurrence of a miracle. All the rest of it, I mean, Buddhism.
But, I mean, people, C.S. Lewis famously, two generations ago, called resurrection the grand miracle. This is the big thing.
Well, and, I knew Lewis, of course.
Did you?
Oh, yes.
Yes, I forgot.
He was...
A living link with one of the immortals.
Oh, yes. Oh, for heaven's sake. He ran the Socratic Club, yeah. And my first publication, which was established ultimately some sort of record in the number of different languages in which it had been reprinted, my answer to what seemed to me the obstreperous behaviour of, the logical positivists. And I wrote this article as a devastation of logical positivism, and it was very successful indeed.
Well, Lewis would have enjoyed that.
Yeah. Oh, Lewis enjoyed that, yes.
He's talking about his article, Theology and Falsification, which has been called the most reproduced essay, philosophical essay in the 20th century, in a variety of, not reproduced as in copies, but reproduced in terms of collections of essays and so on. And he delivered that as a student, 1947-ish, something.
I think that's right, yes.
At the Socratic Club. So an early form of this famous essay was read to C.S. Lewis.
In the hearing of C.S. Lewis.
He also was present for the famous debate between the C.S. Lewis and Elizabeth Anscombe.
Oh, gosh, yes. Oh, yes. And I remember going back over Magdalen Bridge with a party of friends, and immediately behind Elizabeth Anscombe and her friends. And their mood was exultant.
Because they reckoned they'd won. Yes.
They had.
They had won, right. And it's very interesting.
Elizabeth Anscombe was a Roman Catholic.
Sure. That's been written up in Lewis's biographies, of course.
Of course it would have been.
I mean, there's just one point really to press on that. Though logical positivism was abandoned as a serious philosophical scheme, so that famously A.J. Eyre said towards the end of his life, when asked what was wrong with your basic philosophy, what would you now say about your basic philosophy? He said, well, trouble was it was basically wrong, which was quite a damaging admission.
Oh, yes.
But my sense is, and I'd like your comments on this, that there are an awful lot of people within kind of not very philosophically educated Britain today who just assume something of a sort of low-grade version of logical positivism. Mm. So that, for instance, even the BBC divides its programs into factual and non-factual, which is a pretty silly way of trying to organize a broadcasting system. You know, that there are facts, and we know about them, and we sort of prove them, and then there's all sorts of other things which are mere opinions and impressions. And it seems to me that though the system has been abandoned, that's how a lot of people still think.
It may be true, but it's a very silly position. I mean, what are you going to do with the facts? God has some opinions about them, and there's a desire to change them. You know, everything in discussion depends on going beyond mere facts as such.
Well, we only have about 2 minutes here. You might want to take a crack. I know the book's going to be coming over here pretty soon. What would you say to detractors, as the New York Times Magazine, of which we were both a part, and the U.S., Tom, you're probably in that one too, I don't know, the interview, which just treated Tony in an embarrassing manner and tried to say evangelicals are taking advantage of him and they don't let him speak for himself and so on and so on. But the main complaint that's come up in the States is that you have said, well, Roy interviewed me and wrote this down, and so the critics have said, this isn't your book, these aren't your words. I know you have some strong feelings about that.
Well, a lot of the words are bits of reprints of articles I wrote in the past, for heaven's sake. But I don't let something go into print as my publication, before having read it carefully and repeatedly, and that's my opinion. I mean, the book is me. I would say something about the interviewer, who I gave him something that would have been a sensation, a reference and a copy of my book arguing for the impossibility of a future life. This is one of the reasons which I don't believe in. And that book is of great importance and is going to play a great part when all my relevant books go to the library of the Central University in Budapest. And the idea of my writing a book just to please someone, but that interview didn't care about the truth.
He's talking about the New York Times.
The New York Times interview. You know, I gave him a possible sensation, something, you know, here is my important book. It's no one's been able to show any fault. They've tried to. I have established, in my view, the impossibility of a future life. Well, if that isn't news, I don't know what. But that man was so concerned to discredit me that he threw away the chance of producing a bestseller that would have. I can't think of anything better. I can't understand his mentality. How he got a hatred of me in a few minutes. Or
I think the American scene is even more sharply polarized than ours. And belief and non-belief seem to be bundled up with political issues in a way that is much less so over here.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes British people find it really quite difficult to understand why the Americans get so sharp about it. But your interviewer was obviously sitting on the other side and just didn't want to know. We do have, unfortunately, bad broadcasting and journalistic techniques like that here for perhaps other reasons.
Yeah.
On which happy note.
I think you folks can see after a little interview like this, I don't think he's in any danger of senility. So if you hear that critique, you can say, I heard him first here, and it's not true.
Good. Well, I am honored to share a platform with you, sir, after all this time.
I too had to read some of Professor Anthony Flew's essays when I was an undergraduate at Durham University, and so it's a great privilege to meet him live and in the flesh. It's been a great joy to hear this debate.